This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Long-lived and long-banned chemicals are emerging back into our environment as another unplanned feature of climate change. Kimberly Rain Miner is a research assistant professor at the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine. After Hurricane Florence hit the Carolinas in September, Kimberly Miner and two associates issued a warning. Published as a letter in the journal Science, the title is Preventing Chemical Release in Hurricanes. The new reality is stranger than you think, and it goes way beyond hurricanes. From Maine, Kimberly Miner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks so much.
Why did you and your team write that letter to Science?
We wanted to reiterate that it was really important to understand the amount and characteristics of any chemical outflow that could be occurring during a storm. Hurricanes are already really big and scary and involve a lot of people and resources. And sometimes these secondary risks or compounding risks can be overlooked, and they're often really important.
All right, well, let's step back a bit. What are some of the chemicals that we might be concerned about that could reemerge?
What we saw from some of the more recent hurricanes is that there can be a really significant mix. Runoff from highways, which can also be any different kind of form of oil that's used in a car. Chemical release from chemical plants that do processing or production. There's also some issues with farming and industrial farming. So animals that are contained in a certain area that either have input to their diet or have fecal matter that outflows, that carries a lot of nitrogen. It can carry a lot of different products that we don't want in the nearby ocean.
If we picture Hurricane Florence grinding away over the coastline of the Carolinas and Georgia, is it possible that some of these toxic chemicals could be tossed into the air and transported, and if so, how far?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's definitely possible. It would really depend on the composition and the weight, the molecular mass of the chemicals. It would also depend on how they were transported. So, for example, sometimes chemicals can be transported attached to rain or particulates in clouds. Can also be transported attached to snow. So it's possible that they evaporated in the near air and then they were moved in a more concentrated form, like snow. They can travel longer distances.
You know, Kimberly, most of the studies and the news reports that I see focus on a particular chemical, like PCBs. There are hardly any studies of the real health impact of the kind of stew that comes out after one of these disasters. Has there been some research on that? And if so, could you talk to us about it?
Sure. In general, it's more challenging to do a risk assessment of human health with a compound of chemicals. So there's a couple different ways that the EPA suggests that risks are assessed in chemical uptake, and it's very more straightforward to do it with single chemicals. So it's possible to do an environmental risk model for uptake of, like you said, PCBs or DDT. But combining numerous different chemicals when we're not 100% sure how people are coming into contact with them or how frequently, it makes it more challenging to get really definitive numbers. And so research groups have done it. The EPA does do assessments of compound chemical intakes, but it's definitely more of a challenge than doing individual assessments.
Well, just so I understand, if we have one cancer-causing chemical and we mix it with two more risky chemicals, does that up to a risk greater than each of the three involved?
It depends on a few things. It depends on how people are getting each chemical. So if they're eating one of the chemicals, but they're just walking past and inhaling another of one of the chemicals, then the risk wouldn't be the same. The one that you're eating, the risk would be significantly higher. So it depends on the medium, but it also depends on the chemicals. Not all chemicals are created equal. And even though a number of different kinds of chemical might cause cancer, the kind of cancer, the severity of the cancer, where the cancer is able to grow in the body, it's all different.
A friend of mine who does help with Radio EcoShock went to areas hit by Florence as a Red Cross volunteer. I'm wondering if toxic materials transported by storms are a risk to first responders, or is it because they're there for such a short time, maybe it's really the evacuees returning home that would develop the long-standing risk? What do you think?
Yeah, I think probably both, but I think they're going to be different. So that was something we did want to address in the Science article, was that first responders may be the first to come in contact with the highest concentrations of chemicals before dilution or runoff or evaporation occurs. So there is definitely a risk to first responders that's possible. However, that long-term risk that you're talking about, when people come back to their homes and their homes are inundated with water or with sewage or sludge, that's also potentially a significant risk because they're going to be in that environment for longer term. It would be a great study to see which one is more significant, but I'm not sure that that's been accomplished yet, either in methodology or in real time.
Yeah, I just talked with a friend from California who said that after the forest fires ran through Redwood, California last year, that before people could rebuild, a lot of them had to dig up to 2 feet of the soil around their houses out and replace it with cleaner soil because so much toxic materials were in homes that were destroyed and businesses and the general environment there.
Yeah, so it's something we don't really think about, these unseen chemicals that are supporting us and around us in our daily lives. You know, they might be brominated flame retardants in our mattresses. They may be part of the plastic bags that we're carrying our groceries home in. But it's when these emergencies occur and under different new climatological regimes, it's definitely something that needs to be discussed and analyzed more thoroughly as to how these chemicals are being released and where they're going.
And you mentioned compounding risk, and I know you study that, but I don't really understand what it means. What is it about?
Well, it gets at your question earlier about different kinds of chemicals and how they add together to increase risk. So the idea behind a compounding risk is basically that if you have, let's use chemicals as an example. So if you have uptake of DDT, but then you also are in a house that has asbestos, then you're going to have two different kinds of risk, and your immune system is going to be impacted by both, which is compounding the impact of each, really.
And when we come to new exposures, whether it's from storms or fires or any other cause, do you think the safety regulations are ready for chemical mixes that pop up in the real world?
I think it's hard for regulatory agencies, because this field is really in its infancy, understanding the ways that climate change impacts release of chemicals into the environment is something that folks have been working on for 10 or 15 years. But it's changing constantly as the climatological regime changes. The dynamics of each ecosystem are changing, and that's going to impact the ways and locations that chemicals are released.
I know that doctors and pharmacists have to be aware about the interactions of taking several drugs at a time. So it does surprise me that the world of chemical regulation has been so slow to catch up to this reality.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the challenge is that the environment is very difficult to model. There are a lot of sinks and flows that are maybe not thoroughly understood at any given time. And the ways that the full ecosystem works together is something that we're really still trying to understand comprehensively. So as we get better at getting a full systems perspective of each ecosystem and the way that they interact with each other, we'll definitely be able to understand chemical flows better. It's just right now, it's something that we're still working on.
And related to the title of your letter to the journal Science, how can we prevent chemical release during hurricanes?
Well, I think the first thing is just being aware that it's a possibility. So once we know that it's possible that flooding can release chemicals in the environment, then we can talk about the necessity of different storage methods. We can talk about where and how we are storing chemicals, and then we can talk about potential regulations for making sure that folks are going to stay safe, even with extreme flooding.
That would be a huge project, because I know that, you know, various agrochemicals and there's just storage tanks all over the place. Some are underground, but some are well above ground. And so to stormproof all of that, it could take decades.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long it would take, but it definitely seems that the more that this is happening, it's going to need to become a greater priority to make sure that we don't have this uncontrolled release of chemicals into the environment.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is research professor Kimberly Rain Miner from the University of Maine. Kimberly, let's move on to your work on another way that long-lived toxic chemicals return to us, and again, driven by climate change. Danish scientist and ice specialist Jason Box recently released photos showing glaciers on Greenland had turned dark gray, and the cause was polluted dust from the industrialized northern hemisphere landing on the ice. And that dust, we presume, contains all kinds of nasty pollutants. And some of them are from decades before we woke up and banned them. We banned PCBs, I think it was 1978 or 79, and now they're coming back out. Now, as you and a group of Swiss scientists report, quote, persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, are entrained within glaciers globally, and they are reemerging in many alpine ecosystems. Please talk to us about that.
For my PhD work, there was this very interesting genre of research that was just beginning, and it was this idea that glacier water is not as clean as we think it is. It just began as an idea that some researchers in Canada and Switzerland had, and as they progressed in their research, it became clear that not only was glacier water not as clean as we had initially hoped it would be, but that there were inputs from legacy chemicals, like you were mentioning, that were occurring. So there were inputs from legacy chemicals that were reemerging from the glaciers. The ones that we looked at in my lab group were PCBs and DDT. As you remember, DDT was banned because of its significant impacts in ecosystems. And there was a genuine understanding and appreciation for how bad these chemicals could be. And so when they were banned, I think there was a hope that that was kind of the end of that genre of chemical. Now, what we've been finding is that because chemicals can be carried atmospherically in snow, like we discussed, when snow carrying these chemicals lands on glaciers, if the glacier is accumulating mass, then it will just travel down through the glacier, becoming fern and then ice, and the chemicals are still there. So in a system where we're warming, in a climate warming system, the glaciers are melting and these chemicals are being released back into the ecosystem in a concentrated form. So whereas they were traveling atmospherically before and may have had, you know, minimal impact, there is a concentrating factor that occurs with the transformation from snow to fern to ice. And then as the glaciers are melting, they're re-released into the ecosystem where they can be taken up in the adipose tissue and the fat of fish or even of humans downstream.
Well, you've just called into question about six brands of bottled waters that all say glacier fed, you know. Could we even see things like PCBs in our water, or could the water look crystal clear and still have small amounts of these contaminants?
Yeah, so that's the unfortunate part, is it's very difficult to see any of these chemicals in glacier water. I tested glacier water, so it's definitely possible to do a little bit of lab work and get a handle on what's in your water. But for anyone who doesn't have a world-class chemistry set at home, it's going to be very difficult to understand what's in your glacier water or any other form of water that you get from these high alpine lakes.
Where did you study this in Switzerland, and what did you find specifically in the glacier you studied there?
So the glacier that we studied in Switzerland, I collaborated with some colleagues from ETH Zurich and from the Paul Scherrer Institute. And what we were able to find is that there is an impact, a risk impact of cancer and of non-cancer, or what the EPA calls hazard impacts, to specifically children downstream, but also potentially to adults who live their lifetime in the downstream areas of this glacier that we studied. So like we mentioned earlier about the compounding risk, I just looked at PCBs. And there is potential that there are other chemicals in these Swiss glaciers that have traveled from northern Italy, where there's some factories, or from other parts of the world. So all of the numbers for children were above the threshold. And what that really means in the risk assessment that we did is that further work needs to be done. We need to discuss further what is happening and in this ecosystem and what the risks are. And that's what we recommended in the paper, is that further individualized study start to occur.
The abstract in your paper says, quote, glaciers in the European Alps house the largest known quantity of persistent organic pollutants in the Northern Hemisphere. I would never have guessed that, and I'm not sure why that's true.
So previous to my work, there were ice core scrapings taken in Canada. There was an ice core taken in Svalbard. And there was this one taken in Switzerland, and there was one taken in the Italian Alps as well. And what we found, what those researchers found, and then what I found later in the core I took in Alaska, was that because Switzerland is co-located with so many countries, and because of the way that the weather patterns work in Switzerland and through the Alps, it's a really nice stopping point for chemicals. So chemicals that are in the region, maybe like I said, that are coming from northern Italy, can sometimes be trapped in the Swiss Alps as they rise a little bit higher and it gets cold and then snow comes down. So it actually makes a lot of sense that the Swiss Alps would become a place that these chemicals would end up residing long term because of the growth of industry around Switzerland, and also because of the specific dynamics around altitude and temperature within the Swiss Alps.
Well, if PCBs have to go somewhere, I guess it would sound okay that they head off to the mountain somewhere and end up in a glacier. But the trouble is, as we both know, the world is warming and scientists are beginning to predict the end of glaciers outside the polar regions. Ice sheets all over the world, from the United States to the Himalayas, are beginning to melt. Does that suggest a second release of chemicals harmful to countless people living downstream?
So that's what we're predicting. Not only were we showing that PCBs are being released into the watershed from this glacier, but my work that's coming out in the next month shows that DDT is being released into the watershed in Alaska. And we can also assume that things like brominated flame retardants and other chemicals that are newer than this class of legacy chemicals are also part of this chemical mix, I guess you could say, that's coming out of the glacier water. So that's the concern, is that if they had stayed in the glacier, this would be almost like a little trash heap of atmospherically deposited and released chemicals. But however, since the glaciers are melting, it becomes a problem for the downstream residents.
And do we know at this point whether those chemicals will go all the way down the rivers to the oceans, or will more of it settle along the riverbeds, or do we know what happens to them?
So I think it depends on the watershed. So any glacier that feeds directly into the ocean, it can definitely head into the ocean. Some of the environmental models that my work is predicated on show that these chemicals can settle into the sediment and maybe reburied into the sediment, which is, you know, another place for them to reside until the sediment is disturbed. They can also go into the fatty tissues of animals or of humans, and that can be passed down generationally. So they would probably continue through the system that way. So there are a number of different ways that they get transported, and yeah, some of them may eventually end up in the ocean, but there are stops before that.
Well, just something you just said, let's say a mother has some PCBs in her fat, and I'll bet you most mothers on Earth do right now. How does that get passed on to the child?
So the mother has a couple of different routes that they can pass on to a child. One is in the womb, and there have been studies that show that there is a placental transfer to children. The other is in the breast milk. So there is the potential, because there's a lot of fat in breast milk, for it to pass on to the children while they're breastfeeding.
Scary stuff. So Kimberly Miner, in a shock to scientists around the world, in 2007, the summer sea ice in the Arctic also melted back. Is it possible that event released more toxic pollutants into the sea and into the marine food web.
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible. And I think that we're starting to get an understanding of how all of these chemicals are going to be interacting in the marine food web and in the ocean. And I think that it's a significant field that needs to be looked at further, but it could be a significant impact as well to the marine life that are getting all of these numerous impacts, one might even say compounding impacts, within their ecosystem.
Yeah, we know whales in the Arctic are loaded with PCBs already and other persistent organic pollutants. So we've talked about dangerous long-lived chemicals emerging from glaciers and perhaps being whipped up by or released by hurricanes. But you also study sociopolitical risk as compounded by changes in climate, ending a quote there. Can you enlarge on that?
Some of the other work that I do with the Center for Climate and Security in Washington, D.C., and some of my other projects there, focus on the way that climate impacts human behavior and can lead to increase of violence or migration, and how that can be a challenge for governments to deal with if they didn't understand that these dynamics were going to be emergent.
From the University of Maine, we have been speaking with Kimberly Rain Miner, a research assistant professor at the Climate Change Institute. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kimberly, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith, saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station.